In the beginning of the social media and news media, they had a lot in common.
This is the Backstory, Media Freedom Podcast.
When social media was developed, the engineers, they didn't realize how dangerous could be. And we see so many new problems that were not expected.
Social media is just that. Social, connections, engagement. It's opened up new channels for journalists to connect with their audience, but with mixed results.
The main attack for us came through Twitter on a variety of fronts. Chatbots to either deliberately troll us or to put out fake news to distract and distort crucial public information.
With the rise of trolling, online harassment, and the manipulation of social media, how do journalists and editors see the role of social media today?
I'm more skeptical than I was 5 or 6 years ago, but I think social media has delivered more good than bad.
How are journalists adapting? How can they move forward in these seemingly chaotic times? Welcome to The Backstory, a podcast from WANIFRA, the World Association of Newspapers and News Publishers. I'm Andrew Heslop, WANIFRA's Press Freedom Director. Each month, we talk to journalists and media practitioners around the world about an issue facing them and their profession. This episode, social media, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Platforms such as Facebook and Twitter have allowed for an increasingly connected world, but not all connections are positive. Karabo Rajuli is the advocacy coordinator of the Amabungani Centre for Investigative Journalism in South Africa. The centre had an experience recently that reveals the challenges faced by news organisations in the Facebook era. Amabungani broke the Gupta Leaks story. They, along with other media organisations, obtained emails of a prominent family in South Africa, the Guptas, which showed their undue influence over politics. This, like all major news stories these days, drew attacks on social media.
The main attack for us came through Twitter. Fake accounts purchased en masse, programmed to either deliberately troll us and the team members or to put out fake news or alternative narratives. So one bot would tweet, and then all the bots would retweet that one bot's tweet to try and drown out actual factual information on social media platforms. So it was quite severe, both in terms of personal backlash, but then also this idea of false news being intentionally weaponized to distract and distort crucial public information.
Amabungani had an interesting approach to pushing back the onslaught, and Karabo will tell us more about that later. But first, let's step back and consider more broadly the question of journalism and social media. Recent revelations about the mining and use of Facebook data by the Cambridge Analytica consulting company revealed issues of privacy. Julie Pacetti has thought a lot about this and other issues journalists face on social media. She's a senior research fellow at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism at the University of Oxford, and she's just taken over the Institute's new Journalism Innovation Project, which, we should add, gets funding from Facebook. She previously worked for Fairfax Media, which publishes the Sydney Morning Herald along with a range of regional and community newspapers in Australia and New Zealand. Julie has long been a proponent, and evangelist even, of the use of social media by journalists, but recently she has become more sceptical. We started talking a bit about history.
It started social media as a revolution within industry. About 10 years ago, that started with YouTube. We had Facebook and then Twitter. And it began with a kind of phenomenon like an avalanche of journalists spilling onto Twitter as a platform because it had such a parallel, I think, with breaking news services, wire services, for example. You know, it was a live, exciting medium that allowed kind of real-time reportage of events by reporters in an unmediated way.
So what changed?
There was, of course, the great intervention of the audience. And that is really, I think, what fundamentally changed journalistic practice, that direct engagement with audiences that had an effect on the way in which journalists framed their stories to an extent, also the way in which they regarded the audience. And that was a dramatic shift. It delivered increased diversity in terms of voices and sources, potentially. Of course, that has always depended on how you curate your audience, but it allowed for borderless communication, so instant connections with either experts or witnesses to events, for example, in ways that we hadn't previously experienced.
There are increasing alarm bells about social media. What are some of the problems in terms of news organisations and journalists using the platforms?
There are alarm bells, and you know, to reflect for a minute on what the Cambridge Analytica story has told us, I think for journalists, fundamentally, it goes to issues around privacy. You know, we, especially as investigative journalists, we depend on communications with sources. And if those channels are being used to communicate, then we've seen through this scandal just how incredibly porous they are. That serves as a warning, which is, you know, a warning bell I've been sounding for some time, just around the need to get yourself trained in digital safety and security, and to be really aware of the fact that with these companies, you are the commodity and your data is the commodity. So, yes, many of these apps are now encrypted, but I wouldn't be doing investigative journalism using Messenger, for example.
It's not just about the personal privacy angle, though, is it? It's also that media organizations over the last 5-10 years have really been encouraged to collect the data themselves of their users and their communities. What lessons should the news business perhaps draw from the whole Cambridge Analytica story?
I think that's a really important point. We can, as news organizations, as editors, as publishers and journalists, you know, decry the Facebook situation with Cambridge Analytica and talk about deleting our accounts. But we have to acknowledge, as you point out, that that kind of data harvesting has become a fundamental aspect of digital journalism profitability, you know, trying to get people, for example, to share their personal details as an entry point for gaining access to content, which is a, you know, a central pillar of monetizing news. But again, with what effect, and what is the due diligence around preserving the privacy of those individuals? And I just, the second main thing that has emerged as problematic around social media is online harassment, particularly gendered harassment. So where women journalists are being targeted, often of a sexual nature, certainly more prolifically than their male colleagues. And there's lots of data and evidence now internationally that demonstrates that. I think that's really challenging because you cannot say to your reporters in this era, you need to abandon social media in your practice. You have to, as a news manager, for example, conceive of ways to protect and defend your journalists at the same time as remaining engaged with audiences. The question is, how do we actually civilize the conversation?
Is it possible to open a space for discourse, for dialogue, without also facilitating all of the negative, nasty elements like harassment? Is there a line between openness and toxicity that we can police or expect to happen organically?
I hope so. And I hope the answer isn't just regulation and more regulation. But we, as a sort of international community of humans, even if we're well-intentioned citizens, many of us have not, you know, developed the skills necessary to be judicious consumers of information. So, you know, we have the disinformation crisis, which is, you know, the third consequence of the social media revolution, the speed with which disinformation spreads and the ease with which people can manipulate it. But I think at the same time, there's an upskilling of individual citizens in terms of their knowledge about how to protect themselves, how to defend themselves, what's appropriate and what's not appropriate.
In that respect, how much responsibility do media organisations themselves have in policing the information that they put out there?
That's the critical question. I think that news organisations have a significant responsibility. Legally, it's a grey area. It varies around the world. But in reality, trying to police or even manage, you know, multiple social media accounts across multiple time zones is exceedingly difficult and it takes enormous resources. I've witnessed this when I was working with Fairfax Media on, you know, incendiary stories where a troll would start deliberately trying to inflame a situation, really resorting to hate speech or misogyny, for example, and trying to, you know, manage that by making a comment as a moderator and saying, look, we have community guidelines, please respect your fellow users. And you can do that to an extent. But if you're being attacked in a sort of pile-on where somebody's, you know, tapping somebody else and then before you know it, there's 100 people who've jammed into a session like that, there's really not a lot you can do other than, if it's possible, close comments or delete, you know, and it's exhausting and it distracts from the daily business of reportage. So I think the answer is media organisations have a responsibility, absolutely. One of the great consequences of reporters developing trust with their audiences through social media engagement is that aside from the situations where you have Russian troll farms, you know, attacking you or your reporting, which happens, the fact that you can have a conversation and you can actually help bring back an argument.
Do you think there's a risk, the more that journalists are asked to become moderators, is there a risk of perhaps lowering standards for the profession, or are we spending too much time policing the comments and actually getting on and doing our jobs?
It depends on what your role is. If I can talk about, you know, being a political journalist in Australia, if you're not engaged with audiences through social media platforms, you're often missing out on the politicians who are going direct with audiences. You're also missing out on some of the knowledge that's been harnessed by academics, by lawyers, by other professional scientists who use those sorts of platforms to share their own knowledge. So, you know, your point is important that there needs to be a strategic approach to social media where you go, right, I'm going to spend half an hour this morning reading and sharing and talking to my readers because I'm not on deadline, and maybe I'll come back at midday and maybe I'll come back in the evening once I'm sharing content to discuss it. And I think we're slowly figuring that out.
Overall, for journalists and journalism, do the benefits outweigh the problems with social media?
I'm more sceptical than I was 5 or 6 years ago, but I'm still a believer in the basic equation that I think social media has delivered more good than bad. I think we can still say that there has been, you know, a democratizing effect. Oddly, even though we're talking about social media being the disruptive force that has possibly derailed democracies. But in terms of journalism, these platforms are still important to us in terms of connecting with audiences. I think what we're doing, though, is moderating perhaps the time we spend there, and also publishers and editors reconsidering how much we trust the social platforms when they say, we're here for the news business and we want to help you. That, I think, requires a degree of scepticism that perhaps was suspended previously.
Julie Pacetti runs the Journalism Innovation Project at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism at the University of Oxford. She was also a Winifred Research Fellow in Paris between 2014 and 2015. You're listening to The Backstory, a media freedom podcast. Julie Pizzetti struck an optimistic chord, but not everyone is so embracing. Marcelo Reck has written critically about social media, even though he spends his days working with it as the editorial vice president of the RBS Group, one of the largest media organizations in Brazil, a country which has some of the highest use of social media in the world. Marcelo told me that the interests of news media and social media are no longer aligned. One is looking for the truth, the other engagement, and they're not always compatible.
The business model of social media is based in engagement. And the problem is that this engagement that's stronger in stories that are emotional or surprising, particularly spectacular stories that are not exactly the truth, they bring more engagement to the platforms.
Marcelo, you work for one of Brazil's largest communications group. So in effect, you're playing that game as well. Can you give us some examples of how your company uses that?
We still use the social media to funnel conversions to the newspapers or subscriptions. But this is less and less important. It becomes so unimportant at certain point for the biggest newspaper in Brazil, Folha de São Paulo, that they just left Facebook. So they just quit all the content, their own content in the Facebook.
So how did they get away from Facebook? How did they decouple themselves?
Well, they just quit. They stopped to insert their content in Facebook.
Just like that?
Just like that. They can't avoid that. Someone take the content and share in their own social platform. A user, no, a customer, copy and paste and share in the platform. But their own content, so the page of Folha de São Paulo, doesn't bring any story anymore. They used to distribute about 60 stories per day, and they just quit this. Facebook at the time represented probably not more than 10% of the accesses to the newspaper. I recognize that some media that depends dramatically on Facebook, it's going to be much tougher to just quit. But maybe it's a trend because the Facebook recently changed its algorithm to highlight content that is shared by relatives and friends and to give less importance, less presence for news media. For us, the problem is that it's well documented that there is no real money for the news media world that can be made in social media. It's an unequal relationship currently, because 80%, that's in Brazil, but it also happens in most of the countries, 80% of the digital money goes just to the duopoly, Google and Facebook.
What are you and your organization doing about this? Are we in a position in terms of the professional media of just waiting around for the social media platforms to change themselves, or are we being proactive in some of the efforts that we're making to bring that change about?
The main task, not just from an RBS group in Zero Hora, which is the flagship newspaper, but I would say in the Brazilian Newspaper Association, is to make a big effort to position the newspaper as a source of truth that is valuable, and consequently it is charged differently from the free content, and to position ourselves as a source of truth against this wild territory of lies and manipulations in the internet. I'll give you an example. An activist, a community leader, important one in Rio, he also a local representative. She was shot and killed in the traffic when she was sitting in her car. During the weekend, the internet, mainly via social platforms, spread a lot of fake news about her, saying that she was married to a drug dealer. There are many, many, many fake stories about her and that she was killed due to this war among drug dealers in Brazil. In less than 36, 48 hours, the fake news were provided, fake pictures, fake stories were provided in order to criminalize her and not the killers. And not just Zero Hora, but many newspapers and media and professional media outlets, we did a huge effort to debunk the fake news.
Did it work, getting that truth out?
Well, 36, 48 hours after the rise of the fake stories are almost vanished. Usually people don't like to realize that they share a fake story. So they are ashamed of it. And when they realize through our paper, from TV, from radio, from the professional news media, even in the social platform, in Twitter and so on, the spread of this particular fake story almost ended. And this is an important role, so a fundamental role of professional journalism is more than reporting stories that are happening right now, is to certify what is truth and what's not true.
Is there anything positive currently about social media?
Oh, yes, sure. Of course, there are people and lots of segments of the society that will never have their voice public because it's impossible for a news company to bring the voices of everybody. So this is something that we have to recognize. But I have to say that social media has a strong role to make public relations of different people, different social movements and companies, etc. And journalism has this different mission. Journalism is not an activism. So the biggest challenge in the years to come is how we can connect the social media world to the world of the news media. We have to find where is the bridge, where is the real bridge that can connect these both worlds.
Marcelo Reck is the editorial vice president of the RBS Group in Brazil. He's also a former president of the World Editors Forum. Now, Marcelo talked about how journalists can offer a counter-narrative to false news that spreads on social media. Let's go back to the story we began this episode with. In South Africa, the Amabangani Center for Investigative Journalism found itself the target of a massive chatbot onslaught after it published a series of articles on the involvement of the Gupta family in South African politics. Amabangani advocacy coordinator Karabo Rajuli told me that the reaction was not to back down. They continued doing their investigative work, including into the very story of the social media attacks themselves.
One of our reporters did an investigative expose around what was behind these chatbots, which led to this revelation that actually the Gupta family were paying a UK-based PR agency called Bell Pottinger to create these fake bots. And this became a powerful tool, not just only for ourselves to counter the kinds of social media attacks that we're getting, but also for the public to be able to really rise up and stand against Bell Pottinger. What we saw in South Africa were ordinary citizens coming forward to say, we will not accept fake news being weaponized in this way.
You talked about individual trolling. How did the individual journalists involved with the investigation deal with that aspect?
There's different tactics which people recommend to deal with these type of chatbots. One tactic is just ignore them, don't feed the troll. Others would say, no, rather confront the false narrative and engage with it. One of the trends that has been spoken about has been the particular vulnerability of women reporters on social media. And this is not just a South African thing, but this is a general trend. So what has been important for us is that it's been spoken about. And I think that has really helped with solidarity and dealing with the psychological effects of no single report feeling as if it's just me. But honestly, I think more could be done around what should be done in these circumstances. But I think one of the most powerful things for our own investigative unit was breaking the story behind the chatbots themselves. And I think that became a powerful tool, both in terms of defense and advocacy against the personal attacks.
Has the experience overall of being targeted, has it made you want to move away from social media?
Not at all. There were probably a few times when I felt as if it was too much, but it wasn't. It hasn't been sustained over a long period. What it has done, though, is that we've had to just consider good principles and what to put on social media and what not to put on social media. And so knowing that those principles are in place for myself and I think for other team members gives us confidence to still be on social media. And also because although we've experienced the dark side of social media, we've also seen the gains of being on social media platforms to engage in public discussions. We are an independent nonprofit media and we want our content to reach audiences as wide as possible. And so we intentionally put all of our content onto social media platforms.
What would you think of the statement, social media is a danger to democratic society?
I'd say that's a statement straight out of the mouth of state security agencies. Our government is very interested in the internet and in social media. They see it as a threat, risk to democracy, a threat to social cohesion, saying these platforms need to be regulated.
South Africa is considering, as a result, legislation that looks to crack down on fake news. Do you think it'll help or indeed hinder the work that you're engaged in?
Our government has recently drafted what's called our Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill. And there's also another piece of legislation called Prevention of Hate Speech Bill. And both of those will criminalize the dissemination of false news. And the difficulty here is that we don't have a definition of what false news is. And in this particular Cyber Crimes Bill, it doesn't offer a definition, but then also extends us to say that false news can also include news which is insulting, which is problematic because a lot of the work of investigative units of reporters is to say not so nice things about people in power. And that's an important function of journalism. It's an important function within a democracy. And we're concerned that these types of criminalization of malicious communication will actually have the effect of chilling the work of investigative journalism, but also just normal reporting. There is harmful content, but in South Africa, we've got a range of other laws and regulations in place which deal with defamation or deal with genuine criminal action. And our view is if we really want to have a democracy where there is robust discussions, these types of laws cannot be passed into law. And there are all sorts of other remedies around dealing with the pervasiveness of false news, which won't have the same kind of chilling, detrimental effect for journalists and journalism.
Karabo Rajuli is the advocacy coordinator for the Amabungani Centre for Investigative Journalism. She's also the chair of the WANIFRA South Africa Media Freedom Committee. There have been many issues raised in these conversations, and we'll be exploring more of them in future episodes. If you want to dig deeper, you can also visit our website, wan-ifra.org. That's wan-ifra.org. There, you can also sign up for our Media Freedom newsletter. We do encourage you to subscribe to this show, The Backstory of Media Freedom Podcast. Our production team includes Mariana Sanz, Colette Davidson, and Sarah Elsis, who edited and mixed the episode. I'm Andrew Heslop, WANIFRA's Press Freedom Director. Thanks for listening.